Amen. Excuse me again. Okay, open up your Bibles, if you would, to Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, and last couple of weeks we've dealt with the Lord's Supper as He initiated the communion supper. And fortunately today we are at the last Sunday of the month, and that's when we partake and celebrate communion. And it's that time of remembrance. It's that time to remember what the Lord truly did for us on the cross at Calvary. And so that's kind of that special thing. And as we saw Jesus in the last couple of weeks sitting at that Passover table with His disciples and explaining what the bread represented and what the juice represented as that body and that blood that was broken and the blood that was shed for you and I. And then last week we saw there he mentioned that one of them would betray Him. One at that table. And we saw last week where as soon as he said that, they kind of wondered, could it be me? Could it be me that would betray him? And then in the very next verse, we see them debating about who would be the greatest. And we talked last week about how we can vacillate so easily, especially if we're dealing with a works-based Christianity and thinking that we are able to do something on our own. But apart from Jesus, he said in John 15:5, apart from me, he said, you can do nothing. You just do nothing that of any eternal significance apart from him. So we pick it up today here in chapter 22 and verse 45. As he had gone out from the Lord's Supper, he'd gone out and he crossed over the Kidron Valley and he'd went up into the Mountain of Olives to pray. And so verse 45 says, when he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. Then he said to them, why do you sleep? Rise up and pray, lest you enter into temptation. Rise up and pray. Rise up and pray. Why do you sleep? Well, because I'm tired. You know, it's hard for us in our fast-paced society to really slow down enough at different times to where we can really, if nothing else, rise up early, to be able to set the alarm clock a few minutes early so you can have a few minutes to pray. But yet, you know, what do we do? As soon as we wake up, I know for myself, my mind starts going on the day. Oh, man, I got this to do, that to do. Well, instead of just thinking about it, that's our time to pray about it, to rise up and pray about those situations. But they were sleeping, it says, from sorrow. They'd just taken in a lot. As the Lord had celebrated the Passover with them, and as they had partaken with him in that, and he had proclaimed basically that he was going to be dead within hours, essentially. And so there was a lot of sorrow going on with them at that point. And there was a lot of things happening, and they just heard that one of them was going to betray him. And you know, when you're grieving, when you're in sorrow, you know, when something's happened and you're going through grief, about the only thing you really want to do is sleep. Let me just go to sleep so I'm not thinking about it. Oh, man, I just got to get it off my mind. So we have a tendency when sorrow strikes us to want to sleep a little bit more. And the disciples seem to be in that same situation. Now we see the betrayal, verse 47. It says, and while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before him and drew near Jesus to kiss him. I think it's worth mentioning here and note that the Lord, in his humanity, God became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, glory of the only begotten of the Father. When Jesus became flesh and dwelt among us, in his humanity, he was not any different from any other men. So in other words, he needed to be identified to this multitude that had come with Judas. This multitude of soldiers, probably at least 6,000 Roman soldiers, were coming up the hill to get one man that had never caused any issues other than turning over the tables in the courtyard of the temple. because of the sin that was taking place there. That was the only thing he'd ever done that would cause any danger to anybody at all. And so he had to be identified. So Jesus as a man was no different than anybody else. And the important part of that is it says that he was tempted in all sin just as we are, and yet without sin. See, Jesus experienced temptation just like we do. Yet he didn't fall into it. He didn't sin. And now Judas comes and kisses him and presents that. And it was common for a student during these days to kiss his rabbi. It was common, and it was a sign of submission as well as affection for the rabbi. Therefore, Judas' kiss would not have seemed unusual in and of itself. However, the language that is written in the original pretty much implies that it was more than just a simple kiss. It implies that Judas was smothering Jesus' cheeks with kisses as if to make sure that the soldiers were able to identify the one that they were supposed to arrest. He didn't just come up and tap him on the cheek. It seems he was just, all over both cheeks. I have a sister in the Lord that I used to ride with in Bikers for Christ, and she always would come up and she would kiss me on a cheek. She was Italian. And she would come up and she would kiss you on the cheek, but she would never kiss you on just one. She would always do both of them. And her comment was, well, Judas betrayed Jesus with just one, and so I do too. But really, when you look at it, he was all over the place there. It was more than just a simple kiss. It was something he was making sure that the soldiers knew who was to be arrested. He was kind of doubling over on the things at that point. And then verse 48 goes on. It says, but Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? I think it's really interesting because as you look at the arrest and the betrayal and the trial of everything that Jesus went through going to the cross, really this is the only time that Jesus spoke back to anyone in any kind of really manner other than just speaking the truth and that. But do you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? This thing that God intended to give to us to show affection, to show honor and love to one another, the enemy was using it to betray the Son of Man. And see, that's what Satan does with everything. All the things that God intends for us to be able to enjoy and to be good and to be, glorious, the enemy has a way of making it ugly. Turning it to evil. I think when you look at the marriage relationship overall, God intended marriage to be between a man and a woman. And the days we're living in, that's not the common belief anymore. It's got twisted. It's gotten to where it's not what God intended. Within a husband and wife, within the marital relationship, the area of physical intimacy is supposed to be a beautiful gift from God. It's something that a husband and wife should enjoy to the fullest, should bring great pleasure to both of them. But the enemy has taken that whole thing of the whole sexual realm and twisted it and brought in pornography and put it down into the gutter. He's taken something that God intended to be such a beautiful thing for a husband and wife, and he's turned it to something evil and ugly and unreal. And so we look at this, do you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? Seeing Jesus asking this is taken, and remember it said a few verses back that Satan had entered into Judas. And so it was just Satan, the enemy, just twisting this sign of affection and turning it for an evil purpose. And the same thing is happening in our world today much, much more. Then verse 49 goes on. It says, when those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus answered and said, permit even this. And he touched his ear and healed him. Of course, we know in other Gospels that it was Peter, of course, that took the sword and cut off the ear of Malchus, the servant of the high priest, and we know it was him and his zeal and those type of things, and yet he cut off his ear, and Jesus, what does he do? He says he touched his ear and healed it. He brought about a healing right at that point. So it looks like Jesus' final healing in this gospel, this finally miracle of healing, actually, was healing a hurt that was unnecessarily inflicted by an overzealous disciple. A healing of a hurt unnecessarily inflicted. See, I think the miracle Jesus does most often is to heal the wounds inflicted by overzealous Christians who, thinking they're standing up for the truth and defending the Lord, for some reason we think we have to defend him, and we unsheath that double-edged sword of the Word of God and we chop off the ears of those around about us. You know, we just pound them with the Word and pound them with Scriptures and just in a way that they can't relate to. And it just like closes their ears in a sense, but yet in a way it's like cutting their ears off so they don't even want to hear us anymore. See, I admire Peter's courage in being willing to be outnumbered probably 6,000 to 1, but his zeal, we find his zeal was misdirected. It wasn't directed in the right direction. So I want to look at some areas where I see that his zeal was misdirected. First, Peter fought the wrong enemy. Essentially, he fought the wrong enemy. And Ephesians 6:12 says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." So when you have an issue with somebody at work, a family member, whatever the case is, it's not them that you're battling with. They're not the struggle that you have. The struggle's against the principalities, against the powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age in the heavenly realm. Unfortunately, they don't stay in the heavenly realm. They come down and work through all those people that get under our skin and cause us those issues. And so Peter was fighting against the wrong enemy. See, our enemy, we need to fight in prayer. We need to stand and fight in prayer because our weapons are not carnal but spiritual, for they're tearing down the strongholds. Now look at that right now. And the next thing, that brings us to the next thing. Peter fought, he used the wrong weapon. He used the wrong weapons. James 3:17 says, "But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy." Okay, so think about this. Look at the words in this verse. Think about the next time or the last time even you had an issue, maybe with a coworker, maybe with a boss, or maybe with a family member, whoever it may be. Was the first thing that came to your mind to be peaceable or gentle when you're dealing with them? Or were you thinking about being willing to yield over to them immediately? Were you full of mercy and good fruits? Were you showing no partiality and without hypocrisy? No, I doubt it. We're humans. The flesh gets in the way. But see, sometimes when we're having a struggle with someone, we need to pray and ask for the wisdom of God. See, it says, "But the wisdom that is from above." The wisdom from above is all of those things that I just mentioned. It's pure. It's gentle. It's willing. See, if we pray and say, "God, how would you have me to deal with this person? Lord, help me deal with them with your wisdom." Man, your whole attitude's going to change. The result is going to change so much faster because our battle is not against flesh and blood. And so when you start having the hair on the back of your head stand up and the veins start to pop out in your neck, that's the time to say, "Lord, I need your wisdom right now." And it's just, you know, you don't have to say it out loud. Just even in your mind, "God, give me wisdom. I need to know how to deal with this person." And God will answer that prayer for you. So Peter, find he dealt with the wrong enemy. He used the wrong weapon. And thirdly, I believe he had the wrong attitude. I believe Peter had the wrong attitude about things. Jesus emerged from this situation rich. Peter thought, man, they're taking everything from him. But in the reality was, what Jesus was doing was making himself rich. Well, what do I mean by that? Because you and I would become his treasure because of him going to the cross. Matthew 13 says, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid. And for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who, when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. See, God, Jesus was eternal with the Father. He is the Godhead. He's the third part of the triune being. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, three but one. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. So Jesus had all that you can even more than imagine. He was in glory since forever. He was the creator of all of these things. He had everything. But we were that pearl. That pearl that he paid a great price for. We were that pearl that he came to die on that cross for. And so as Peter's attitude was, I gotta stop this, because what's going to, what are they doing to him? And he had the wrong attitude. We have to have the attitude about our trials. That, you know what? All things are working together for good to those that love God and are called according to his purpose. That's where we are today. That's the place that we find ourselves, is before the cross saying, Lord, I don't know why this happened and I can't see any good coming from it, but I have to trust in you. I want the attitude of gratitude. I want to just be thankful in the midst of the storm. I want to stay like that evergreen and just be thankful for all things in all ways. And the fourth thing that we see is Peter fought at the wrong time. God's timing is perfect. There would be battles for Peter to fight in the spiritual realm, but now was not the time. After the crucifixion, we see Peter take up the mantle of being an evangelist, being a leader, being a man of God that would bring multitudes to the Lord. He fought the fight better afterwards, and yet this was the wrong time. This wasn't the time to fight. Jesus had to go to the cross. That's why he came to the earth. That was his mission. That was his purpose. That's why everything that we've been reading about in Luke has been driving him to Jerusalem for this very thing. This is just not the time to fight. And so he fought at the wrong time. And then the next thing is, Peter fought for the wrong reason. Peter thought he was protecting the Lord. You know, how many times do we think we have to protect the Lord's name? Or try to make it, you know, we have to do something to disprove something somebody said about the Lord. You know, God is able to handle that a lot better than we are. You know, it's always interesting to see how God works things out. You know, sometimes you can be having a coworker, man, and they're just that thorn in your flesh. And, you know, they're not doing their jobs right. Everything's terrible. And it just, you know, it's just crazy having them there. And if you find that instead of grumbling and complaining about them, if you start to pray and ask the Lord to deal with them, before you know it, they're gone. It just seems like the Lord takes you out of that situation. And it's always neat to see how the Lord kind of blesses us and gives us little signs and little things that show that his justice and his timing is better, and that his reason for happening, doing things is better. And so we just have to know that, God, what do you want us to do? How do you want us to handle this? And so all of these situations, all of these things, the wrong weapon, the wrong attitude, the wrong time, all of these things, we do them every day. We just fall into them. They're just natural of the flesh. It's natural for our self man to just kind of do these things first and foremost. That's why Jesus says, rise up and pray. See, if you pray before you start your day, then it'll be easier not to fall into these things. You still probably fall into one or two of them, or maybe all of them, like some of us do sometimes. But at the same time, if you rise up and pray, as Jesus said, rise up and pray that you may not fall in temptation, that we won't be tempted to use the wrong weapon. We won't be tempted then to do it at the wrong time or have the wrong attitude. All of these things that are there, if we rise up and pray, God will go before us. He will minister to us and he will speak to our hearts concerning the things that we confront throughout our day. He's faithful. He's faithful and just to do those things each and every day for us. And it goes on in verse 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priest, captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. So Jesus asked them a simple question. You're coming out with this army? 6,000 men? He said, I was there sitting in the temple teaching every day, and you didn't do anything. But he says, but I realize this is your hour. He knew it was God's timing. He knew it was his time, and it was their time to come and do what they were doing and arrest him. He'd been there. They could have grabbed him at any time. Of course, as we'd read, the religious leaders didn't want that to happen and are afraid because of fear of what the people would do. And the religious leaders wanted to make sure that they weren't to blame for this. That's why it was being done the way that it was being done. And it was the power of darkness. And this was truly a dark hour indeed at that point. But yet we know that the light is coming. The resurrection is coming. And even though the cross is as terrible as it is, and we'll be going through it the next couple of weeks, and as terrible that as it was and is, there's more. That didn't end there. They had their time now, but Jesus had his time on that resurrection morning as he came forth. And then it goes on in verse 54. It says, having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance. So they led him to the high priest's house. And the high priest at this time was Caiaphas. Every week I struggle with that name. You know, what is it? Caiaphas. There it is. See, I practiced it all morning. I did it just like she said it all morning. And then I get here and it's like, okay, how did I say that? Anyway, the high priest, you know who he is. Yeah. But anyway, the high priest during the life and ministry of Jesus, he was the official head of the Jewish state. He was the one that presided over the council of the Sanhedrin. And that was the highest court in the nation at that time. And he, next to the Roman governor, he was the most powerful man in Judah. And he was responsible to the Romans for how the nation conducted themselves. And so there was a lot of stuff going on with the zealots during this time, and there was a lot of talk about revolting against the Romans. And so Caiaphas, he was the one that was kind of, he had to answer to the Romans and the Roman authorities for what was going on. So he was a little bit concerned about all of these people that were now following after Jesus and listening to him, because he didn't know what was going to happen about it. And so Caiaphas was therefore especially concerned. He was especially concerned about all this enthusiasm and the political unrest centering around the ministry of Jesus. And he was concerned about what implications it may have as an end result of all this. And because, like I say, there was this revolutionary sentiment going about during this time. And the activities of the zealots, they were increasing more and more. And he was sure that they were soon to break out in some kind of open revolt. And the Romans would have held him responsible. And he kind of saw Jesus as being one that could have led that revolt. But he didn't realize that he was leading a different revolt. He was fighting a different battle. Jesus was fighting the battle for our lives, for our eternities, for to free us up from sin, not just to free Israel from the Romans. But then the other thing is, it says that Peter followed at a distance. He kept his distance. He got back. See, following Jesus at a distance is always, always a dangerous place to be. Following him at a distance. Verse 55 says, now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. So first we see he's following Jesus at a distance. Now we see he sits down with the wrong crowd. He kind of gets involved in that. That's what happens when you start to distance yourself from the Lord. You start to find yourself fellowshipping and being apart with the wrong group of people again. You kind of have a tendency to go back to those old friends, those old ways, turning back instead of moving forward. Because at a distance is always a dangerous place to be. So he sits down with the wrong crowd. Now it says they started a fire, and you know that attracted Peter. Evidently he was cold. Evidently he had a chill about him. And we saw Jesus, when Jesus was praying in the garden, he was sweating blood. He was warm. He was so hot that his sweat as it was drops of blood. Peter, in the meantime, was sleeping in the garden, so it seems he had a chill about him. He was cold. So I believe the difference between being hot and cold is simply prayer. It comes back to prayer. Everything we're seeing here deals with prayer. All of the things that Peter did wrong to Malchus by cutting off his ear is because he didn't rise up and pray. And here he's cold. So he goes and warms himself by the fire of the enemy. He warms himself as he sits down by the enemy's fire. So too for us, if we're following Jesus at a distance, we'll feel a chill inside. You know when you start to break away from the Lord. You know when you're not fellowshipping as much. You know when you're not reading as much. And you especially know when you're not praying as much. When you're not in prayer, you know you feel that chill inside. And sometimes we ignore it, but hopefully you're in tune to it and you draw back. All we have to do is turn back and receive him back and welcome him back. But when we have that chill, sometimes it's easy to go back. It's easy to go back to the old places, to the old ways to get warm, something that we're familiar with. Oh, I remember I felt good at that. And we go back to that, but it's only temporary. It didn't satisfy in the past. It will never satisfy in the future. Because the problem is when you warm yourself by the enemy's fire, like Peter did, you'll get burned. You'll end up getting burned at the enemy's fire. It always happens. Then verse 56. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. And she looked intently at him. Verse 57. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. She knew that he had walked with Jesus, but he denied it and said, woman, I do not know him. And verse 58 said, "But and after a while, a little while, another saw him and said, you also are of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. I am not. Peter was identified, he was identified as a disciple of Jesus based on two things. Two things that we see here as he sat by this fire. The first thing that the maiden, this woman, as she looked at him intently, she realized that he had been with Jesus. He was with Jesus, so she identified him as a disciple because he had been with Jesus. Do people identify us because we've been with Jesus? Do they recognize us as that? And the second thing that identified him by the next man was he recognized him as a disciple because he was with the other disciples. So he was with Jesus, and he was with the other disciples in an ongoing basis there. So therefore, this shows us two characteristics of a disciple. Two things that if we're disciples, these should be, both characteristics should be in our lives. They should be evident to those around about us, just as they were evident to these people as they looked upon Peter. They saw that he was with Jesus, and they saw that he was with the other disciples. Two characteristics. See, you can hang out in church all the time, but if you don't spend personal and private time with the Lord, you're really not a disciple. You can be here as many times as the doors open, but if you're not spending alone, quality, intimate, one-on-one time with Jesus, are you really a disciple? Do you portray that characteristic by that? No, I don't think so. And then on the other hand, you can enjoy spending time with the Lord and stay home, read the Bible, and study and pray and all those things. But if you don't want to worship with other believers, are you really a disciple then? I think it takes both characteristics in our life for the world around us to see Jesus in us, to see and identify us as a disciple. See, you will be identified as a disciple even by the enemies of the Lord when you do both of those things. When you enjoy spending time with the Lord and enjoy fellowshipping with believers, and if you spend that time with him personally and fellowship with believers corporately, then people will automatically identify you as a disciple. They can't help but. Because when you're spending intimate one-on-one quality time with the Lord, then when you go out and you have fellowship with the body of Christ, then you take the things that the Lord showed you in your time and you use it to encourage those around about you. Or if you're going through something and you have that fellowship time, someone else is there to encourage you because they've been spending personal time with the Lord. That's why fellowship is so important to us. That's why as believers we come together and we do that. You know, yesterday afternoon we had the celebration of life for Cecilia, and afterwards we had a potluck downstairs. And I don't know, it ended about 4:30 or something like that. I don't remember exactly what time that ended. And then we had scheduled the Koinonia potluck at 6 o'clock last night. And so a couple of hours in between in order to let some of the dessert go down and be back. And somebody said to me at the first thing, they said, well, why didn't you just cancel this thing tonight? And I thought, well, you know, why? You know, it's just another opportunity to come together and eat more dessert. No. It's more time to come together and lift and build one another up. And, you know, as I looked around the fellowship last night and the tables were there, more people came than I expected. Believe me, it was a great turnout, I believe, for having that. And as I looked at, we had the tables were filled up, and as I looked at the people sitting around talking and laughing and just enjoying one another, I thought, see, this wouldn't have happened if we canceled it. And there was a couple of guests that somebody invited some guests and some friends with them. And so, you know, you don't, just because you do something one part of the day doesn't mean you can't do it the next day. There's plenty of time for fellowship. There's plenty of time, and it's always a good thing. So we see these two characteristics that they identified Peter. He was with Jesus, and he was with the other disciples. Those are two characteristics I think that we all can spend more time developing in our own lives as disciples of Christ and being able to know his will in our lives. Then verse 59 goes on, then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, Surely this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean. Peter's accent had gave him away this time. So too, believers are identified by their speech. You know, he had this accent. You know, Tom's from New York by the way he talks. You know, they just have this accent. They have these things. You know, so they have an accent of another location. Peter had an accent and of this of being a Galilean. As a born again believer, we take on a different communication, a different vocabulary. We don't use the same expressions or the same tone as the world does. Colossians 3, verse 8 says, "But now you yourselves are also to put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language, out of your mouth." See, those things, when we become born again, those seem to automatically kind of fade away. If not right at first, within some time, as you mature in the Lord, then all of a sudden, we start to lose the quick to anger. We start to lose having wrath toward others. We don't harbor malice in our hearts any longer for anybody else. We stop blaspheming. We cut out filthy language, hopefully, out of our lives. Those things leave, and our vocabulary changes. We're no longer lucky. We're now blessed. See how our vocabulary changed? You know, at my old church, we didn't call them potlucks anymore. We called them pot blessings. You know, because we don't have luck in the Lord. So our vocabulary changes, and Peter's vocabulary was different. And that's the third thing that they used to identify him as a disciple. And then verse 60 goes on and says, "But Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you are saying.' Immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed." So as a result of the rooster crowing, no longer, I believe, Peter would be so cocky. Remember, he told the Lord, "I'll go with you everywhere. I'll go to prison. I'll even die for you." But he wasn't that way now. See, writing in his epistle, Peter identified himself as Simon Peter, what? A servant of Jesus Christ. His attitude changed. Simon was his name before he became a disciple. It meant sifting sand or unstable one. The Lord changed Simon's name to Peter, our rock. But after this event, after he denied the Lord, it was as if he said, "Yes, I'm Peter, in the Lord by grace, but I'm still also Simon because I know my tendency to fail." That's where we all are. God has given us that new character, that new nature, but we still have the flesh. We still have the old man that is working away. That's the sanctifying work. Sanctification is, the word sanctification in the scriptures is always in the present tense in the Greek. And what that means is a continual habitual action. We're always being sanctified, drawn more and more, and created more and more into the image of Jesus. And that's what his work that he does in us in that way. So Peter at this time says, "I know I'm Peter by his grace, but I'm still that sifting sand. I'm still that unstable one, able to fail." See, I think there's something else here too. I believe in using the rooster. The Lord was telling Peter that even though he messed up, even though he committed a singularly hideous sin in denying Jesus, even as Jesus was about to die for him, there would be a new day dawning. See, we relate roosters to that morning, that new start, that new day. And I think the Lord allowed that rooster to crow just to show that Peter, that there was a new day coming. There would be that new start, a new day of humility, a new day of brokenness, a new day of forgiveness, after which he would use Peter mightily. And I believe the same is true for us. We will find the Lord will do a mighty work in and through us, even at the point of failure, if all you do is turn to him. Just turn to him. Allow him to be real in your life at that point. And so today, like I say, we have the opportunity today to partake in communion, to be able to remember all the things that the Lord has done for us, all the things that He has spoken into our hearts and into our lives and created in us that new work and that new design for our lives. And so as the worship team comes forward, we'll just be able to have the